This is the Registry Podcast.
Welcome to the Real Perspectives Podcast. In today's show, we peel back the layers of design and innovation, and we're honored to be joined by the co-founders of Verse Design, Paul Tang and Courtney Bauer. Paul brings a unique blend of technical expertise and creative vision to the table. With a background in both engineering and design, Paul has the rare ability to bridge the gap between form and function, making him a leading figure in the design industry. Joining him is Courtney Bauer, whose attention to detail and understanding of user experience have established her as an influential voice in design thinking and strategy. Together, they lead Verse Design with a commitment to excellence and innovation, transforming ideas into impactful solutions. Paul and Courtney share their insights on the challenges and triumphs of the design process, discuss the latest trends in technology and design, and explore how design shapes our daily lives and future. Now, let's give a warm welcome to our guests, Paul Tang and Courtney Bauer.
Courtney, Paul, good afternoon. How are you?
We're good. Thank you.
Excellent. How are you both doing? Where do we find you today?
We are in downtown Los Angeles.
Sunny California.
Excellent. Sunny California. Wonderful. Back at the office. Is the office buzzing again with active energy? We're here in early 2024, so I'm curious, you know, how are you guys doing? How is the industry doing overall? And are you optimistic about sort of early start of the year, how things are going?
We've noticed a significant jump maybe starting last month. Prior to that, in fact, the entire 2023 was very, very deadly.
Okay. And we'll get into that a little bit. So that's good.
But our office is, everyone is here in the office, and you know, we're up on the 12th floor of our building, and so people are here and happy to kind of be in the office and working together.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, as a way of introduction, would you mind giving us a little bit of a background in terms of, you know, you in the industry, but also a little bit about, you know, how you met, how the company was founded? I think it would be a nice sort of way for our listeners to learn a little bit more about the firm.
So Paul and I, we were lucky enough to meet through the academic world. Both of us are kind of rooted in academics and educating not just our students, but also our employees and imparting what information we have to kind of our clients and communities as well. So we met, Paul was doing some traveling abroad for work. He was teaching a studio at USC and I needed a substitute, and we were connected that way, which really kind of started our partnership. You know, we didn't know that it was going to be a partnership at all at that point, but that's where it started. And what year was that, Paul? 2008 or 2009? I think I get it wrong.
2009.
Okay, yeah.
I think you were correct. I was wrong.
So 2009, we did that studio together. It went well. And in the meantime, Paul was beginning to make some moves to transition over to China with a couple of different pursuits, one of which we worked on together. So it was an invited competition for the Bangu High-Speed Rail. We worked with his team here and guided that competition submission, which ultimately we won that contract. And so Paul was able to take part of the team over to Shanghai with an academic position as well. Let Paul talk about that. But the competition in this academic position allowed him to kind of make that first move over to China. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, so it's interesting. The impetus for me to move wasn't really the competition, because I think we could have done the competition here or executed the needs from here. At that moment in time, my practice is really less about, well, let's put it this way. My wife called my practice my hobby. my real breadwinner is I was teaching at USC. By 2009, I had been there for 16 years.
Okay.
Yeah, and so, you know, that was kind of the area where I really was focusing on. So, therefore, the practice was always sort of secondary to my academic work.
Makes sense. And the project that you guys won in Shanghai, was that related to the teaching? Was it sort of separate? Tell us a little bit about that.
It was for, so China at that moment in time was starting to do their high-speed rail system. And so I believe out of the 7 stations, 2 or 3 of them was put out there internationally for a design competition. We were invited to one of them. Maybe it wasn't even an invitation. Maybe we signed up for it. I don't quite remember. And part of it was, it's really 2 separate things altogether. There was the teaching side. There was the assignment. So I actually became the director of the American Academy in China. And then there was this competition that, because we were slow, 2009 is a year after the Great Recession,
sure,
where everybody's twiddling their thumbs, right? We decided we're going to do this competition. In fact, I closed my office. We did it out of my house. You know? And so these 2 different events, the winning of that competition, then the necessity for me to actually be in China because of my position academically, all coincided and culminated in 2010.
Yeah, makes sense. So this project happens. You guys had an opportunity to work together. And was this the genesis of the company, sort of, and your collaboration?
Not quite yet.
Not quite yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in 2009, when I received my assignment to be in China, literally there was no work to be done in the U.S. So, you know, we had a small team. And the decision was I was going to lay everybody off with a little bit of, what do you call it? With a severance, right? The other choice was we take a gamble, we take that little nest egg I had and I'd invested, and we all move. The only person in the end that couldn't move because of family obligation ends up to be Courtney.
Okay.
I was also probably newest to the team, although I was, you know,
right,
kind of acting with Paul as in partnership there. I was newest to the same staff that had been with him.
So there were 5 of us altogether. By May of 2015, I was the last one because I had to finish my semester on campus. I landed in Shanghai on May of 2025, or closer to June. And that's when I really learned that the high-speed rails project is a real project. I mean, it's not just winning the competition. You're actually awarded the project to finish. That then started the company in a way, you know, being in the right place, the right time, having the right pedigree. That same 5 people by 2012, we're closer to 75 people.
Oh, wow.
So it was an enormous growth. And it's also, I think, some of the best years in doing projects in China. Everything was super fast. 2014, I had some of my former clients visit me in Shanghai, saw what we were doing, invited us to participate on another competition for a project in the US. We took a little bit of the risk. Instead of providing a design based on what they requested, we decided to play developers and ran numbers and gave the erroneous advice that they shouldn't do the project. That, in the end, actually allowed us to win the project because the client was a little bit surprised that I would fly in from Shanghai to San Francisco just to tell them not to do the project because the the bad performer that I did actually showed it to be not viable. And I had a numbers wrong. She corrected the number, it all turned to green. I thought I really screwed up.
That's why you said erroneous, right? Because I was wondering how was it erroneous if you ended up winning it later on. So,
well, the difference was two things.
One data point.
We were lucky. Yeah. One, there was no zoning. That property had no zoning fixed at that point. So any kind of design competition is based on God knows what. So it's a beauty contest. Secondarily, even if they selected a project, by the time you then go and meet with the city, you're going to have to start from ground zero. So that helped. And the second thing was we did that. We flew into San Francisco, presented the performance and the project with the message, you should really not do this project. So in essence, what we're doing is we come to San Francisco to tell our clients, don't do the project, and we're going to go home empty-handed. And the client thought, well, wait a second, you're actually not thinking about your design, but you're thinking about my project. Then once we discovered that my numbers are wrong, by one correction, everything turned viable, she looked at me and I was just eating crow. I thought, oh my God, I was never going to do this again. And it ends up, she says, listen, if you were truly concerned about the project to the extent that it's not about you winning the project, but you actually telling me not to do the project and going home empty handed, we're going to award you that project. That's how we got awarded. So I didn't have any entity in the U.S. The client knew that. The client asked me how long would it take me to reset up an office to address her needs. I made two calls, one to my wife saying, hey, we might be moving back home. Second call was to Courtney, say, what are you doing? Can you come back out to L.A., restart the L.A. office for me? And that's how we got started.
Great. Great. So tell us, this may be a little bit of a kind of a, vanity question, but how did the name emerge? How did, how did you then focus on growing the company? And maybe a little bit about, where you thought the focus would be when you first kicked off.
So the name, actually what happened was when I arrived in Shanghai, I quickly realized I have, as a architect who truly believes that what we do is cultural production, yet I'm immersed in a culture, despite the fact that I'm Chinese, I actually know nothing of it. I didn't grow up there. My language is poor. And so instead of partnering up with another foreign architect in the U.S. and have plenty of classmates and colleagues, right, they're all there, I decided to collaborate with a domestic architect. And luckily, because I was in academia, I was introduced to a fellow colleague at Tongji University. So we then pulled our eggs together in the same basket and we created Verse Design. And Verse Design really was a poor attempt at translating my partner's company in Chinese, which I think is far more poetic. It really means architectural language. It could also mean architectural suggestions. It's very well, it's a great name, but I couldn't find the appropriate. And he had a name that's called Archiversion. And so Chinese, if you're an architect, everything's archi, A-R-C-H-I, something else.
Okay.
And I hate that. So that eventually gravitated toward Verse Design.
There's one other bit that we don't usually talk about, but I think is really nice and interesting, is the development of the logo is kind of in the essence of the chaff seals that are prevalent there in China. So the English words scripted in a way formed in a way that resembles those official seals, which is really, really a nice tie-in and bridge, I think.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So tell me then a little bit about the company today. You are based in Los Angeles. Offices anywhere else at this point? Kind of where is your geographic sphere of influence, if you will?
I would say that our influence is beyond LA. We just happen to all live in LA. We still have our sister company in Shanghai. We have some people that is carrying our card in San Francisco. So just within this last 8 years, we've done projects in, obviously in the US, but we've also done some projects in China and Nigeria. So it really comes down, not necessarily geographically, but perhaps to the topic of the type of clientele, right? Which is really much more to do with how I think our company really became much more successful. And one of the biggest shift for us, especially being trained and became an architect in the US, we learned that it's really not about who we are as architects or who our client is. Is that ultimately, when a project works, and I don't mean just great design, right? Because there are great designs out there. There are economic disasters out there, right? Or great designs out there that doesn't perform very well. What we realize that the true client that we need to look at is really not the client that hired us, because typically that's a broker in between, right? Either it's a developer or it's a government agency. It's never really the end user. And so whether it's for private development, which is economically driven, or for a institutional client, which has a larger aspiration, whatever that may be, could potentially be political, but technically they're supposed to be more about the citizenry they're serving. But in the end, we think it's far better if we really begin to understand what a project needs to be and who are we really serving. And even from a private development side, which is the majority of our clients, it's a simple argument. If your project works for the audience that you're going after, it actually works financially as well. In other words, it can be financially successful. So in the end, it comes down to this idea of value, right? So it's no longer about me as being the designer that's in cultural production, but really it's a question about how we as designer can bring value to the people that actually engages with the spaces and the buildings that we create. And where is that value at, right? And there are times when you really got to say, you know, you're right, I need to pull back a little bit because it doesn't present any value. So, you know, lately, since November or maybe earlier this year, you know, we slowly started gravitate towards a different kind of a slogan. It's that form no longer just follow function, it's form follows value. So that, as a way of approaching projects, particularly with our clients, really begins to hit at the core of how we offer our services as a design firm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's super interesting.
Well, she could be the first one because, you know, Courtney has this extraordinary capability to get projects entitled. Right? She managed to help one of our clients as part of the entitlement team, but we were the AOR in that mix, managed to get 16,000 acres of property entitled in less than 3 years. That's unheard of, right? But part of that has to do with, you know, in order to make the right recommendation to a client, you really have to have the knowledge of the context. And I don't just necessarily mean the physical context, right? So between herself and myself, when we put our thinking hats on together, this idea of the context becomes very broad. It's no longer just the tangible physical context. It also becomes the intangible context of, you know, economics, yeah, dollars and cents. How is the project financed? If you have a limited budget, right, it doesn't mean that you can't do it. It just means that you need to find an alternative way of doing it so that it can actually create value based on whatever the limited resources you have, right? So we often will challenge our clients because they all come with a preconceived notions of what will work. And they may be very correct.
What's interesting about that is when you talk about value, I would argue over the last, I don't know, half decade, 5 years, certainly, how we use certain spaces, you know, who's using them, you know, the end user that you, you know, identified in your conversation is not necessarily the end user, you know, 5 years later or 10 years later. Is that something that you can, you know, consider this early in the process? Or is it sort of generic enough where you have kind of a spectrum of end users that you know might be potentially, you know, involved in a certain project at the end of the day, and you design to that?
It can be project specific, but there are definitely different sectors and different projects where we really try and make sure that we're looking at things for multiple uses in how one space is created and looking down the line on what the future could look like. If even if that's kind of a growth pattern that the organization is expecting, or maybe one that we hope to kind of plant the seed for, but ultimately kind of defining those spaces that are a joy to be in and really serve the population, we believe will be a catalyst either in that area or within that specific building, right? To allow to allow the program to grow. And so we do always think about what our project does to the urban fabric, either immediately or larger, and then also kind of those organizations and how it can implement or foster kind of a change or propelling them to their next stage. Because usually when people are looking at renovating or building new, an organization or community, they're stepping into a new chapter, right? Or they've started to look forward. So it's really kind of taking that momentum and shaping it so that they keep that trajectory and it goes the right way.
Yeah. My one follow-up question to that then is also, you know, tell us a little bit about some of the projects that you've done, maybe some of the things that you're, you know, proud of and some accomplishments with maybe clients. Maybe you can't mention certain clients, but certainly maybe the types of projects you hopefully can.
Yeah. So let me back off a little bit. Courtney used a very good word that it's a catalyst, right? I think every new proposed project is always going to be a catalyst of some sort. It's like throwing a pebble into a pond. No matter how you throw it in there, it's going to ripple. It's going to change the ecology of that pond. So in a way, I think other than designing the building, architects are also urbanists, right? It's about urban design. So when a project begins to fit within the existing urban context, not to mention it could also become the catalyst to make it something somewhat new or different. That's the projective part of it. That's the catalytic part of it that looks to the future. So in a way, from that perspective, as a urban design exercise, when you begin to see and envision what the project can be, not just physically, but also programmatically, right? What are the type of uses most appropriate, right? And I make fun of this to some clients who says, build me a shopping center and with a desire to sell all the stores without any kind of control. And I said, what if a mortuary decide to buy one of the prime spaces and put a mortuary right there? What's going to happen to all the rest of your space, right? So
is this a go-to question that you have, Paul? Because that's a very specific question.
Oh yeah,
but it makes a very good point as well.
Right. So going back again to the project that brought us home, you know, the fact that because we felt that there was a lack of zoning, right? But we felt that we can probably exceed the area, but you know, your area limitation is always not the key. It's really like, what is the market really looking for? So when a client came to us and said, hey, listen, you know what? At that moment in time in 2015, what is hot in Silicon Valley is what they call single tenants. They'll come in, they'll take the entire building.
Sure.
Right. But these are like the Amazons, the Apples, and you know, the big tech boys. But there is a minimum square footage requirement of 200,000 square feet. And that was kind of the sole brief we've been given as our target. Although in the end, we were very fortunate when the building was fully leased in 2022, as the entire office market crashed. But there was a period in 2021 when we were helping the client to say, okay, now we no longer have an office market. What other functions can we put into this building, right? So way back at the beginning of design, we actually started looking at it and say, well, in addition to a 200,000 square feet floor plate, total size for a single tenant, what are the other kind of needs out there, right? We narrowed it down to like a 40 to 45,000 square feet floor plate as a single tenant per floor is kind of your next desirable number. So we were very fortunate, before Amazon decided to take over the whole building, that was the direction we were actually going. And there was no regrets because it was already preconceived in the beginning. And you know, that was a challenge in the beginning from our client to say, why not go higher? Why not, you know, do something different? And I said, no. The reason why we believe this works, it's a lot less about sort of the designs, but I'm looking at the numbers to say, you know, if you look targeting a single tenant, it's 200,000 square feet. If you don't get that tenant, what are you going to do? Next best option is 4x4. And what we then reached out to Cushman & Wakefield, the brokers, and say, listen, what is kind of your next tier of size that generally, you know, companies in pre-IPO are looking for? And the answer was like 35,000-40,000 square feet. Right, so that's one instance. That project, in the end, you know, we're very fortunate. We way exceeded the target 200,000 square feet. And just be aware, for those younger designers, just remember what the city requires in terms of how you calculate the square footage. It's very different than BOMA, which is what the real estate agents use.
Right, right. That's a whole other podcast, I think.
Oh, yeah. But imagine it this way. Just by us understanding the very surface of it, we have a 230,000 square feet maxed out FAR building. Yeah. With a tenant lease to Amazon at 246,000 square feet, right? So it exceeded because the calculation was different, and that could be designed. You can actually design, once you understand that, it's a design input, right? You can design in such a way so you will max out the value of that area without exceeding your FAR.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, and so another good one is like residential, right? Particularly when you're in an urban situation and developer comes to you and says, oh, I need 78 units, all the family, two bedroom, right? And we're looking at the project site that's right across the street from Santana Row in San Jose. Santana Row is kind of like, what would it be equivalent today?
I'm very familiar with Santana Row, so yeah, it's a retail mixed use for our listeners who are not in San Jose.
Pedestrian.
It's a mixed use retail, very pedestrian, very nicely designed, kind of multifamily also, but office as well. Complex. Right. I mean, I don't think it's sort of a street. There's sort of multitudes of, you know, streets that include obviously shops and hotels and that kind of stuff. So
that's right. And so it's right off the main boulevard, Winchester.
Right, right, right.
So our project's on Winchester. And in the end, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, who's going to live on Winchester? It can't possibly be families with kids, right? And so we identified the audience to be people in their early career, obviously with some means, right? They're young, white collar. Single people, which means that their place that they live in is really just where they sleep.
Yeah.
But it needs to have all the amenities to impress, right, your significant other. And so that project is how we challenge our client to say, hey, listen, you much rather do smaller micro units and your efficiency is not that high. In other words, I need to dedicate more areas to the public areas because that's where they meet people, right? That's where they congregate. These are single people, most likely. They're highly mobile. If they're married, they're just young couples and no kids. Right. And so how do you then look at that kind of audience and begin to develop? And then you go back to your client and say, listen, I think your two bedroom idea is totally wrong.
Right. Right. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Over the last few years, I imagine, and certainly on the West Coast, we have seen the entitlement process in general be very difficult. I think maybe given sort of the where the industry is today, it's gotten a little easier. But Courtney, I would love to hear from you kind of, you know, how are you seeing things, you know, our municipalities changing the way that they work with entitlements? Is it becoming easier? And I know specifically this is maybe a California question, but I'm curious also how that translates as you go to other states and other municipalities, you know, away from the West Coast.
Right. So there has been a shift and it is still municipality by municipality. Right. But as some of the smaller municipalities see what their older, larger, big brother and big sister are doing nearby, they're able to kind of follow some of that lead. And those larger cities have a little bit more experience, right? They've just cycled through more projects. And so everyone is more easily able to answer the questions that are asked up front. So I think I'll step back a minute. And one thing that we really try and do for our clients and for all of our projects is make sure that we're having conversations with the city as early as possible with the appropriate stakeholders. And often, you know, sometimes we're there representing the client on our own. Other times we're making sure that they're kind of along in the conversation, because successfully getting through that process is really understanding the desired outcome from both sides of the table and making sure that there's alignment in the expectations. And once we have that, we're able to kind of we specifically are able to kind of coordinate the consultant team and really get the packages together that describe what both entities need out of the package, so that you're not kind of stumbling over submissions because it doesn't include the information that's really important. It also, those early conversations with the right people at the table allow us to make sure that we're hearing the needs of the cities, the focus of the city, and aligning the projects where possible with those expectations for smoother acceptance and approval. So that's a little bit on entitlements. I do think in the last few years, as the municipalities get more comfortable with it, they're ready to answer, okay, we know it takes us about this long to get through this process. As they become more familiar, they're able to articulate that and we're all able to do it together a bit better. And then also they've had time to kind of get their underlying EIRs done for the city, which then if a city has that, infill lots can piggyback on that and the whole process gets a lot smoother.
Yeah, and I realize what you're describing is a bit of a kind of best practices, right, in terms of how you guys approach it and what works. I'm also curious, just in terms of entitlement as a process itself, whether it's getting easier now that there's less of it, perhaps. Maybe there isn't less of it. Maybe there is more of it. Maybe people are still entitling. And where I'm going with this is, you know, people still entitling without sort of maybe a specific understanding of when they're actually going to break ground. And our cities also meeting some of their, you know, needs. Where are we today in terms of that kind of, you know, push and pull, if you will, from both sides?
I mean, we are still seeing our projects need to go through the entitlement process. It really is that effort on the, I'll call it the first developer, who could also be the second developer, but the first development of that, any parcel understanding, one way that it can be re-envisioned and have kind of density or specific programming approved for it, right? And so that's the initial way to generate additional value on that property. And so we are still seeing projects go through that entitlement.
Maybe one of the difference, and I think this is where Courtney's extraordinarily skilled at, is it's never about what our client want or what we want as architects when we approach jurisdictions. Always looking at what is the intent behind the laws or intent behind the procedure requested. And once you kind of understand what that is, you know, there's always an alternate way of doing anything that you can imagine out there. And so when you begin to understand why they're doing certain things or making certain requests in such a way that may not be logical in the beginning, but once you understand their intent and you actually help them understand how you're going to help them reach that intent, it becomes a lot smoother. What we can't help typically is the, you know, is the bureaucracy.
Sure. That's understandable. Yeah. So we are talking here at the sort of end of the first quarter of 2024. Paul, you know, you made some reference to things picking up here in the last month or so. I'm curious, you know, overall from both of you, you know, how are you seeing the market evolve? I'm curious also as architects, you do see kind of things before most people, right? In terms of, you know, development and entitlement and that kind of stuff, right? Where's the industry? Where is it heading? Are you optimistic? Are you, you know, think you're going to be as busy as you were pre-COVID? Some kind of, you know, general thoughts about that.
I think we're going to be back up pretty soon. And I think this is the way I'm positioning that is this, you know, there is always going to be conditions within the market that will make certain product types not very attractive. Like, for example, no one's going to come to us and say, hey, since you won that award in the office building, do us the office building. But I also think that that attitude is very much about just looking in US or perhaps in Southern Cal or even closer just within LA. I think that the younger architects out there with the advancement of all the technology, right? In fact, right now at this very moment, although I know all three of us are in Southern Cal, for all we care, we could be in different parts of the world. It wouldn't matter, right? And so that being said is that there's always some kind of project type that's going to be needed somewhere in the world. And so if you have certain expertise in there, you need to think way beyond just the confines of the borders of where you live or where your office is. We touched on that earlier a little bit, right? It's like where our sphere influence is. And you got to go to where the project is. And now the technologies are going to help us do that, to make that bridge. So that's one. The other thing is very specific to Southern Cal is the 2028 coming up. And so what we notice is where...
And this is the Olympics. You're making the reference to 2028 because of the Olympics.
Right.
So, just to be clear.
Right. So because majority of our clients are private developers, right? And in 2023, they all stopped because the interest rate is too high. Although the interest rate has come down a little bit, it hasn't quite hit the bottom that they're all seeking. Because they all got very spoiled in the last, 10 years, maybe more, where you got interest rates like very, very low. Now it's like, this is the interest rate that maybe our parents were used to in 18%, right? In the 70s. But this younger, the new generation of developers have no experience in that. So for them, it's still high. And what we realize that they're starting projects now is because they're looking at the end date. You know, whatever projects that they want to do, they want to get it done before, you know, at the beginning of the year 2028.
Right.
So that you're operational, you have it in place for the Olympics, right? Not that the Olympics will use that building directly, but because the Olympics, it'll bring on a change in the economics of how things will work and certain attractions and having a project come out at that time is attractive to developers. So that's what we've noticed. But I think the key really is to look at where each of our our area of strength is. And then we really need to push the envelope as a whole, right? We need to really look at the hybridities of what we practice as architecture, you know, because our way of living is changing. So I hate to be saying that you got to get into housing or you got to get into office market or the commercial market, right? Then you're going to have the gloom and doom and say, oh, we're way overbuilt. You're always going to have that. But the thing is, the necessity, the need to renew, right? There's always going to be a need somewhere, somehow. And so the question is, how do you then position yourself in such a way that you have the advantage to attract clients that will come to you?
Right. Yeah. As you look at kind of where the industry and how it's evolving, are you exploring different parts of maybe different specialties, different areas that maybe you didn't do in some of the earlier years of the firm, but now you feel there will be opportunities there? Tell us sort of how are you approaching that opportunity?
So I'm going to let Courtney talk about this a little bit. And this is actually her. It just came to her one day. She came down and sat down with me we're looking at ways how to implement. We being design architects, we like to design more than manage. But because we're design architects, we're like, if we really care about our craft, we're very detailed to the point where, if I could use the word anal retentive on everything across the board. That actually makes us ideal as project managers. So we foster our projects through at every single phase. And the reason really is to make sure that whatever it is that we design gets implemented almost exactly the way we designed it. So Courtney came up with an idea.
Courtney, what was the grand idea?
Simple. I don't know. It's kind of simple at this point, I think, but it's just really kind of this idea that we're ambassadors for our clients and the developers, we're smaller. We punch way above our weight in terms of the size office that we do and the projects that we get involved in and the development that we get involved in. And in part, it's because of the relationship that we build with our clients and these private developers and really work advocate. And so the kind of alternative professional services that we can offer is this project management aspect as an architect, because it's not that we're coming in as a project manager kind of from a business side or exactly a contracting side, but as an architect with those problem solving capabilities that we have, the ability to think about problems, multiple problems at the same time and kind of scale jump between them to understand how you one detail can affect the cost at a much larger size, how one project can affect the urban impact, right? So, jumping across scales, that mindset and those critical thinking skills that architects develop through their practice, provides a different project management perspective to clients. And there are certain size clients, private developers, that really fits in nicely to. But I'm also finding that there are smaller organizations out there that can really benefit from that as well, like some smaller schools, there's charter schools, there's independent groups that can utilize the same.
Right. So essentially vertically integrating some of the tasks effectively, but through the prism of sort of an architect, right? Because you guys have a different perspective and approach than maybe a project manager whose job is just to sort of move, maybe I'm oversimplifying this, but sort of move paper along, right? Through the entitlement process.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We don't want to say that, but their perspective is different. Their perspective is different. Their end goal is maybe, and depending on when they come into a project or can come into association right. with our clients, their end goal may just be understood differently. And where ours is the true benefit of the community and the client and how we define success for the project, it just lends a different perspective to that.
I mean, one good example, we're actually helping a church organization. And they have their architects, and, you know, and we're helping evaluate their next phase of work. You know, as a church, we realize that they have a whole bunch of congregation spaces, and they're looking to build more.
Right, and they're just like, we need another 20 by 20 room. What? For what? Yeah.
So no one questioned it. They just, none of the PMs, anybody, they just say, okay, fine, that's what the client wants. We're going to give it to them. And we're looking at this thing. I say, my God, you got so many congregation spaces, right? If I just revive some of the ones that you haven't thought about for years because it's kind of hidden away, it's renovation.
Or it's disconnected and really.
Right. Yeah. Or could it be that when you're not using this big hall, it just doesn't, it's not just closed with no lights on and you go to this other space, right? Why not look at them with multi-purpose in mind? And that's when we learned that for some people, they don't, because they don't have that experience, they don't necessarily think that way, right? A bedroom is a bedroom, a dining room is a dining room, or a living room is a living room, right? Even to the extent that living room is different from the family room, it's two separate spaces. But in reality, they could be one, right? So, so in that way, it's like, that's part of that ambassadorship. It's that you kind of help them rethink, it's just, well, wait, so why would you need all that? I'd love it. Because more area I get to design, but at the same time, there are times you're saying, well, wait a second, you don't need it. You got better place to put all that resources, right? And that's the good type of management that we're talking about. So it's
and the value. This is the value that you were talking about earlier as well.
It's the value. Exactly. From the very beginning, it comes down to the value.
And it requires a little bit of creativity. And really requires us to be critical in poking at assumptions that's already preconceived and everybody seems to accept. But you say, well, wait a second, that's not true, right?
And I think, you know, thinking about this is from an educational standpoint, and if we're thinking about kind of younger generations in mind, developing the confidence to challenge those things is like, a hard skill to learn, and figuring out when and how to inject that into the conversation so that it's heard and it becomes actionable it's a learned skill, and it takes a little bit of practice, but it's really important because likely I can only imagine that many of the architects or some other people had looked at some of these things and said, well, that maybe not the right best used, but okay, I'm not going to say anything. Somebody else knows better, and I'm not going to mention it. And I'm not going to rock that boat. But, you know, taking the risk, feeling confident in it enough to take the risk to have that conversation, but doing it in a measured way and making sure that you're really thinking about it so that it's not the whim of an architect, but like, hey, this really makes sense. And ultimately, multi-use space, like, our services, generally we get paid by the square foot of the building. So it reduces the project size, reduces the project scope, reduces our fee. Okay. So, but that's okay. If it makes for the best space, there'll be another project to come. And so kind of having that confidence in yourself to really talk about it and speak up when there's a better alternative that should be discussed. It may not, and not to sweat it if it doesn't always take root.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And this is sort of a good segue, but you mentioned, talking to some people coming into the industry. I would like to pivot a little bit and talk a bit about, you know, lessons learned. I mean, obviously you guys are not just architects, but you're business owners as well. You also employ people, right? So those are some interesting challenges too, I'm sure. And at the same time, you know, you have an experience now in this industry that's, you know, a couple of decades. I would love to kind of hear from your side of things, you know, lessons learned for either people entering the industry or maybe even some advice you tell to your younger self if you were able to do this again.
So in a way, it's unfortunate that we're in the U.S. And by that, I mean, in the United States, there's a tendency of the market to kind of pigeonhole you, where you're the specialist in offices, Courtney's a specialist in housing, and another person is a specialist in schools, right? Everything seems to have this cubbyhole that you get stuck in. And in order to break out of that into the next cubbyhole, it takes an enormous amount of convincing. And so this goes back to what Courtney was talking about earlier, right? Is to have the confidence to ask questions. Even if you don't think that the questions are spot on, but you're asking questions, which means that you are caring. And along with that, I would say never trying to create experiences that you don't have, and be very upfront with them to say, listen, I've never done a school. Okay. But you then start asking questions with the client, explore like what makes it so different? Because if you are a competent architect, right, you should be able to do a library to say a school, to say a house or to an office, right? Only when it comes to very specialized like factories that handle chemicals or something really that's far out there. But even then, those areas are going to require specialty consultants. So I would say one other thing is never trying to pretend that you have the experience of certain things. You actually don't, but rather you need to be much more honest about. But then to convince your clients, and I know it works against you in the U.S., is sometimes by asking the questions, it actually shows that you care. And it could be wrong. But from a client perspective, how wrong can you be? Because they're not architects. And so they're actually going to come back and say, well, you know, you're really thinking about my project. And so in the end, it's really not the project type. It's the total amount of responsibility you have as my agent to execute a building. And buildings are not cheap in the United States, no matter where, you know, right? Even an addition relative to the income of the family that needs it, it's substantial. And so we're kind of like money managers. We're spenders. We're definitely spenders, right? Because the only way not to spend is not to do the project. And so we're spenders. The question is, how confident can you allow your client to feel with you as the person in the lead? And I think honesty will always work, and full transparency. We've got one job, so when I told the client, I have no experience doing this, but hey, you know, this is what we've done. These are the questions we have for you. And in the end, I even had one client that looked at me and says, oh, that's a very freshie. Every one I interviewed so far, I said, they've done it. You're the only one that said you don't. And yet I feel very comfortable with you. So I think that for me, at least from my perspective, is where I would give the advice to younger architects. And I know how difficult that might be here in our environment because of the risk management. You've got to have the experience to do it, right? So everyone becomes a doorknob keyhole specialist rather than just architects.
Courtney, your thoughts?
I think I want to add to that, kind of constantly looking forward to what your professional trajectory, where it's headed, where you want it to go, and how you can get there. And it's not something that surprisingly we mentioned much today, but we often talk a lot about, which is collaborators and our collaborators, right? Whether it's our consultant teams or our peers that we that are, you know, freelance to us or other entities, and really looking for those alignments and where you can benefit each other. And that, so when you're in whatever place you're in, and you start to look forward and say, oh, well, I kind of want to be over there. Well, how am I going to get there? Well, you're going to look to your collaborators and how you can start to kind of inch your way in that direction. I think it's really important to keep in mind.
And the biggest secret here, if your collaborator pisses you off to no end, biggest advice is sit on it at least a day before you react. There's no shortage of me and Courtney disagreeing on a design. And what we learn usually is you can't make that decision at the heat of the moment. For the project in Santa Clara, the office building, we did not finalize the color selection until the contractor threatened us with a delay claim if we don't give them the selections within the next 24 hours. And we finally then made the decision. And I got to tell you, she was absolutely correct. I was looking for a cooler, silvery color, and she was leaning towards much a warmer gold color. And I said, who the hell want that building in gold, right? But at the end, we used the champagne color, and that was the right color. Because at certain times of the day, it actually looks silver.
Right, right.
It's the way it picks up the light.
So sit on it, sleep on your decisions. Definitely, that's a piece of advice I can endorse as well. So,
Even if it's a client or a consultant, but use the draft if you're on email as therapeutic, just to get it out of your system, save it, don't send.
I have done that.
Review it the next day.
I'll admit that I've done that.
I do that quite often.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, Courtney and Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. This was wonderful. And love hearing about your company and look forward to learning more over the next few years.
Thank you
so much, Vlad.
That was another episode of the Real Perspectives podcast, and we thank you for taking the time to listen to it. Conversations like these help us comprehend our evolving industry better and hopefully provide a perspective that helps you understand the dynamics of commercial real estate. If you like this episode, please subscribe to our show and tell your colleagues about it. That is the best way to spread the news and help us remain relevant across the industry. Cheers.